You can have creeds and codes and rituals and even constitutions that are transparent to the gospel, or more transparent than some others you could mention. Nothing in this veil of tears is very, permanently great. You're paying a price. There's no free lunch, it seems to me. Every choice you make has some good and some bad in it. But I would be willing to argue that creeds, codes, cults, and constitutions, all of these can either be helpful in showing out your faith, or they can stand in the way of not only your own faith, but the faith of others. So that's going to be my perspective on things. Does it have to be that faith is murdered by religion in every age or in every culture? Does it have to be that Norma Jean Baker dies because she can't live as Marilyn Monroe? As I say, when I heard that lecture, that changed my theology and my life forever, because, you see, I went to seminary in the days when people were saying, well, of course, Christianity is not a religion. Buddhism, Hinduism, Muslim, they're all religions, but Christianity, no, no. But I think the Christian faith has a religious aspect. That is creed, code, cult, and constitution, and you have to come to terms with it, and you constantly have to be on guard reforming it. Semper reformans, am I saying that right? The church is always reforming itself. Martin Luther wasn't the first, and he wasn't the last. And we got constantly to reform ourselves, make sure that those aspects of our religion that are dear to us are nevertheless transparent, or as transparent as we can make them, to faith. Okay, let's take a look now. This is all introductory. We're going to get into the meat of things tomorrow when we get into architecture, and then the body and movement, and then music, and then finally words and signs. Before we get into 2 and 3, however, let us take a break and talk to your neighbor and see if what I said about Marilyn Monroe and faith and religion and so on makes any sense to you. Go ahead, I'll call time on you in a minute, but talk. The problem is this, as I've stated in number 2 there. How do Christians fulfill a biblical mandate to love the world and at the same time not to love the world? That sounds like a paradox or a contradiction, and it is, but let me explain that a little bit. We remember from John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, etc., etc. And I think that's enjoined on us, too. We are to love the world. And we've been hearing wonderful lectures at Holden Village about loving even the creation, you know, the trees and the stars and the stones, the hole in the ozone layer. We ought to love the world. However, 1 John, first letter of John, and even the Gospel of John and some other places talks about the world being the deceiver and the world being a temptation to the flesh and to your faith. The world is wicked, and the world is in the hands of the principalities and powers. And so we're not to love the world, we're to keep the world at a distance. And the question is, how do we do both of those things at once? Well, it's not an easy job, and Christians down through the ages have come up with 5 different answers, and we're going to get into them for a minute. But let's ask for a minute, what do we mean by the world? Well, we mean by the world everything that pertains to the first article of the creed, the humanum. Namely, the so-called orders of creation. You've heard this before, the orders of creation. It's pre-Reformation, I'm pretty sure, isn't it, Michael? I don't think Lutherans invented the orders of creation. But anyhow, the orders of creation are, for instance, the family with its sex differentiation. We have males and females. I have a psychologist friend who says we're all bisexual. And it's from homo to hetero, and somewhere in the middle there is all the rest of us. And all of us have a little bit of this and a little bit of that in us. Anyhow, that's constitutive. Every human being is the product of one mother and one father. The state, that's a civic order. Government, the king, or the ruler, or the parliament, or the president, or whoever, the governor, the magistrate, the law courts, all of that stuff is part of the humanum. You can't do without that kind of order in the world, it seems to me. The economic order, we've been talking a lot about that at Holden Village. Is capitalism the best of all possible systems? I'm living in Canada these days, although I'm an American citizen. And one of the neat things in moving to Canada was socialized, dare I use that word, socialized medicine. My wife died of cancer, as some of you may know, 2 years ago. And she had a major, major surgery that kept her in the hospital for 20 days, and she had a long regimen of chemotherapy that kept her alive for 9 months. But we paid for the telephone at her bedside. Wow. Now, you hear horror stories about the Canadian system, but let me tell you, you hear horror stories about the American system, and in America, the poor are left behind. I mean, if you're poor and sick, you're stuck. In Canada, if you're poor and sick, they take care of you. Well, anyhow, the economic order, from left-wing communism to right-wing laissez-faire fascist capitalism with multinational corporations running everything. Then the third, there were traditionally family, state, economic order, and then so-called the cultural order. Culture now more narrowly understood, and I would be in favor of dividing those into the categories you see there. Family, state, economic order, the arts, science, medicine, and education, and even entertainment and play. Red Skelton is dead now, but just you, some of you old timers remember Red Skelton? Wonderful comic. But I read articles about him in the Sunday Supplement, and he was a Christian. And he said, God has given me the ability to make people laugh. And that's my vocation, to be a clown, to cheer up people's lives, who, you know, people who would otherwise be sad. And boy, he had some sorrow in his own life. Didn't he have a kid? I don't know all of his sorrows, but we all have sorrows. And we all need to laugh and play. And so even that last category there, it seems to me, has something to tell us. Have you ever heard of this term before? Homo ludens. You heard of Homo sapiens. That's smart human being. Homo ludens is playing. Human beings that play. And so we make up and invent games. Monopoly.
He always said, God bless at the end of his game.
What's that?
He always said, God bless at the end of his gigs, yeah. And I always got a lot from that.
I guess he did that, yeah, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, wonderful. Anyhow, we're Homo sapiens. We got a brain and a mind, and we can think and, you know, gain wisdom and knowledge, but we're also Homo ludens. We also like to play, and there's nothing wrong with that. Science, medicine, and education, boy, where would we be without those these days? Technology, my goodness. You're talking to somebody who has an artificial heart valve in the middle of his chest that's keeping me alive. Star Edwards, blup, 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 that kind of a valve. I had that 25 years ago. It's going to last 200 years. When I'm laid out in my coffin, there's going to be blup, 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 blup.
Hear that?
No, it's my own heart that's beating. But the valve, I had a leaky valve, and they repaired it with nylon and stainless steel, can you imagine? And I wear two hearing aids, Lord have mercy. I'm a Luddite. Have you heard Luddite? Not related to Ludens at all, but a Luddite is somebody who's suspicious of technology, and that's me. However, I give technology its due. Okay, the world that we're talking about is the world of the family, the state, the economic order, the cultural order of the arts, including music, architecture. I put fashion in there because it was the most outlandish thing I could think of, but it includes painting, sculpture, literature, poetry, novels, what other arts? Dance, theater, what other arts are there? You know, even fashion, even the way you dress. And then science, education, and medicine, and entertainment and play. Those are the so-called, the old traditional orders of creation, and the question is, how do you live as a faithful Christian in all of those things? It ain't easy. How do you live as a faithful Christian in a family? With a spouse, or kids, or parents? How do you live as a faithful Christian and a citizen of the state? If Hitler says, burn the Jews, do you burn the Jews? How about living as a Christian in the economic order with this consumerism? Boy, Epcot. Have any of you been to Epcot Center? Wonderful place. I mean, a great playground. Talk about entertainment and play. I mean, it's a wonderful, and it's an exhibit of all the world's cultures. And here's little Switzerland, and here's little France, and here's little Germany, you know, all these with architecture to fit. And even the trash cans are designed to fit in with whether it's Germany or Switzerland or France or whatever. And on the top of each trash can, it says, "Waste, please." And I wonder if that's a noun or a verb. Ooh, you know what I mean? Are we being encouraged to waste? Anyhow, how do you live in that? How do you live as an artist? How do you live as a person of science or medicine or education or any of those? Can you see the board meeting people over there? Anyhow, let's get into the meat of things, which is good old H. Richard Niebuhr. H. Richard Niebuhr, probably more influential ultimately than his more famous brother Reinhold Niebuhr. He wrote a book called Christ and Culture. X there is the Greek chi. You will excuse me for abbreviating. It's not being irreverent. It's just an abbreviation. Christ and Culture is the title of his book. And he says, down through the ages, Christians have answered the question, how to love the world without loving the world, in the following five ways. Now, I took graduate work at Syracuse University, and I had a teacher who claimed he was working on number six, which hadn't been invented until he came along. But he really was number five, I think. We'll get to that in a minute. Okay, one and two, let's look at each of them in turn, and then we'll talk. How are we doing? Okay. One and two are, in the first case, far left, and in the second case, far right, answers to that question. Incidentally, I should say, all of these are chronological. This is how they appeared in time. However, all of them are also contemporaneous. In other words, you can find Christians today who buy into any one of those. And some of us may buy into a little of them at different times in our life or at different moments as occasion demands. I'd be willing to call myself number four, but I must say there's sometimes that the number one looks pretty good to me, and even number two looks pretty good to me. Anyhow, let's take a look at them. As I say, they appeared in history in this order. Christ against culture is the view that says this: you've got to make a choice. You've got to decide between the world and faith, the demands of faith. So at its most radical, now not everyone in position number one is this radical, but at its most radical, you do not get married, family. You dig? You remain celibate. At its most radical, you renounce your citizenship and any citizenship. At its most radical, you don't even work. Economic order, you know, is labor and capital and that kind of stuff. How do you earn your daily bread? Butcher, baker, candlestick maker, pastor. And at its most radical, people in position number one would be mendicant. I mean, they'd be beggars. Or hunter-gatherers, scroungers, I suppose. The culture, the art, science, and medicine, education, entertainment, and play, all of that you have to reject if you're going to be a Christian. Christian does not go to the movies. Christian, if you're a good Christian, you do not go to art galleries or concerts, because all of that stuff is going to seduce you away from faith. You can see this is a pretty radical position, but boy, that's the way the first letter of John comes off in the Bible a lot of times, and even the Gospel of John. So all of these are biblical. There isn't one that's more biblical than another, I don't think. And they all got their plus, their positive side, and they all have their negative sides too. Okay, that's the far left position that says you have to choose, you have to make a choice. And you choose for faith if you're a Christian, and you reject the family, the state, the economic system, and the culture. And as I say, you can find some Christians today who buy into that. Okay, number two is, as you might guess, the far extreme on the right, the other end of the continuum. And this didn't happen until Constantine. What's the year for Constantine? 326, something like that? Fourth century, anyhow. Fourth century, Constantine not only became a Christian himself, but he made Christianity tolerated in the empire, and more than that, he made it the official religion of the empire. And so this is the view that says, you don't have to choose. To be one is to be the other. To be a Christian is to be in a family, working out your vocation there. To be a Christian, of course, is to be a loyal citizen of the state. Do whatever the king or the emperor tells you to do. You're beginning to see some problems in this view, and I see some problems in this view. The economic order, sure, whatever it is, you give your allegiance to it, and there's no problem, there's no... What you're doing, in position number two, is kind of baptizing everything. You're... this is the era of baptism by fire hose. you're saying there's no conflict, there's no problem, no need to make any kind of a choice. You're born into this world, first article of the creed, and that... the second article and the third article will come right along with it. You don't have to worry. And there's some awfully nice things about position number two, giving us quote unquote Christendom. You know, Christendom was pretty nice when you look back at it. You're born not just a citizen of Sweden, you're also a member of the Church of Sweden, Lutheran. You know, automatically, I think until very recently, isn't that true, that, you know, baptism didn't even make any difference? I think they've changed that, have they not now?
Yes.
I think they're separate.
No longer state.
Yeah, I thought so. And maybe some of the other countries, too, where this was the case. Okay, moving along. Left and right are at either end of a spectrum or a continuum, and in the middle, there are three views that are a little more subtle, a little more compromised and compromising. And they are 3, 4, and 5. What Niebuhr calls Christ above culture, he has a word for it, syntheticism. Spelling is not my long suit. Did I spell syntheticism right? Yeah, it's S-I-S, isn't it, at the end? Okay, 4, Christ and culture in paradox, dualism. And 5, Christ, the transformer of culture, what he calls conversionism. For whatever it's worth to you, position number 3 is High Roman Catholicism. Position number 4 is Martin Luther. And position number 5 is John Calvin. And you should probably be warned, H. Richard Niebuhr is himself a Calvinist, Reformed. And, you know, he sees all of this as a kind of a culmination. That, you know, there's a little bit of that in him that, well, surely 5 is the best. But I like 4. Let's go into each of them. 3. This is the view that he says puts Christ above culture. It gives culture, namely the family, the state, the economic order, the cultural order of the arts, the cultural order of science, medicine, and education, and even the cultural order of entertainment and play, gives each of them their own autonomy. There is a sense in which each of these things plays by its own rules and has its own authenticity, doesn't need anything else. However, if the Pope and the Emperor ever have an argument, the Pope wins. I mean, this is a kind of shorthand way of saying it. In other words, the Church and Christ's representatives on earth are custodians and guardians and sponsors of the culture. You might even say, what's the word I'm looking for? Cultural, you know, it was the Church that invented the cathedrals in the Middle Ages. It's the Church that invented hospitals. It's the Church that invented universities. I mean, you could argue the Muslims have their own version and the Chinese their own, Lord knows. But this view, view number three, sees the role of the church and the role of faith as having the last word, you might say, and providing an umbrella. The church is the patron of the arts. So in the Middle Ages, you have these, I'll get you to you in a minute, you have the flowering of all these magnificent art forms, you know, from architecture to painting to Gregorian chant and music and all the rest of it. The church is the patron, the guardian. That's another word I could use. Custodian of culture. Go ahead.
I was going to say the book Angela's Ashes, if you've read that. To me, that...
Have you read that book?
That
you must read it.
Reeks of that.
Yeah, exactly. It'll have you laughing one minute and crying the next minute. Oh, that's a wonderful book. Read Angela's Ashes. Do they have it in the bookstore?
I don't know.
Anyhow.
But the power of the church.
But that's true. You see, he's growing up in a Roman Catholic... He's growing up in Ireland as a poor Roman Catholic kid in a poor Roman Catholic family. And it's full of this stuff, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. What does high mean when you say high Roman Catholicism?
Well, 13th century, Thomas Aquinas. I should give you some names connected with each of these. Let's go back a minute. Position number one there, Christ against culture, emphasizing the opposition between Christ and culture. You've got the first letter of John. You've got Tertullian, early church teacher. Monasticism, you know, you can see how monasticism grew out of number one. Tolstoy, boy, he was a weird fellow. I mean, a great author, but also kind of weird personally. And then there's some modern sects and modern Christians as well. Position number two, the Christ of culture, representing the agreement between Christ and culture. Gnosticism, which would have been an early Christian aberration or heresy. Peter Abelard of Abelard and Heloise, you know their story. He apparently thought in these ways. Thomas Jefferson apparently thought in these ways. This is all according to H. Richard Niebuhr, friends. I don't know much about these people myself. Hegel, philosopher Hegel of the 18th century. Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, he would have been in position number two. Ritschl, Dietrich Ritschl, I don't know him, but H. Richard Niebuhr says he belongs in number two. Okay, Christ above culture, that's what we're talking about now. Syntheticism, emphasizing Christ as the custodian or the guardian or the patron of culture. Clement of Alexandria, Thomas Aquinas, as you might expect. And traditional Roman Catholicism. I suppose just before Luther and just after Luther, to answer you as precisely as I can, Gene. Okay, let's move on to D. Pardon me, four. That's Christ and culture in paradox, dualism. This is where Martin Luther belongs. And this is a view, it's the most difficult, I think, of the five. For people to get their head around. But again, it grants each of these orders of creation a certain autonomy, a certain authenticity of its own, and it tries to say that God is dealing with the human race with the right hand and with the left hand. This is sometimes called the doctrine of the two kingdoms. The kingdom on the right hand is the place for faith and the church. And it's the it's where love rules and nothing else. But the kingdom on the left hand, that's the orders of creation. That's the first article of the creed. And the church belongs there too, believe me, because it's got creed, code, cult, and constitution. You see what I'm saying? And the kingdom on the left hand is the power to compel obedience, for instance, in the case of the state. And in the case of the family, the structures of father and mother and children and so on, that provides a structure for human life that we would be poor without. And further, the kingdom on the right hand, with its only concern being love, that can work through the left hand, mixing my metaphors here and Luther's metaphors too. It's love that is... It is love that is behind justice, for instance, in the case of the civil order. the state. It's supposed to be love behind the economic order. It's supposed to be love working in the arts and in science and in entertainment even. Back to Red Skelton again. So living as a Christian is walking this tightrope, this tension between the demands of these orders of creation on the one hand and the demands of love and faith on the other hand. And when you screw up, you say a prayer of forgiveness. And, says Luther, you're going to screw up. And that's why he says sin boldly. You know the end of that quote, don't you? Sin boldly, but believe and trust in Christ more boldly still. And he's saying most of the decisions that you will make in this first article of the Creed, the family, the state, the economic order, the cultural order, and so on, most of those decisions that you make are not between pure white and pure black, or pure good and pure evil, but they are discriminations between shades of gray. And you're paying a price, and you're getting your hands dirty. You're even getting your hands bloody. You cannot avoid it. You ever read the book or see the movie The Cruel Sea? Nicholas Montserrat. Good illustration there. The hero of the book is the commander of a British destroyer escort in Second World War. And it's the job of the destroyer escort to escort a convoy of ships from North America to Britain and back again, giving supplies and troops and so on to the war effort. And it's the job of the destroyer escort to search for submarines, U-boats, German U-boats. And the situation at the climax of the book is this. A German submarine, a German U-boat, has indeed got into the convoy and sunk a British ship. And here in the water in front of this destroyer escort are all the survivors of this ship hollering for rescue and safety. At that very moment, the commander of the destroyer escort sees on his radar or sonar, whatever they had in those days, that the sub, the villain, is right below him. What does he do? Does he drop the depth charge, get the submarine, and kill all of his own men on the surface who are waiting for rescue? Or does he stop, pick up the men, rescue them, and let the sub get away? Tough choice. He decides he's going to drop the depth charge and kill his own men. And then he says, you have to do what you have to do and say your prayers. That's life, isn't it? I mean, I think number four is a very realistic position. That human life is a lot of difficult choices. And sometimes you don't make the right one. And even when you make the right one, there's some misgivings maybe, or some gray area there that you gotta ask for forgiveness of God and of your neighbors.
I don't know if I'm right about this, but I always think of...
A little louder, so these people...
I don't know if I'm right about this, but I always think of Reinhold Niebuhr in this category. Mm-hmm. Christian realism.
Okay.
Would you go along with that?
Spell that, yeah. That would be number four?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would think so, because... He's always admonishing his readers to be grounded in reality and realize there's no simple answer to a difficult question.
Luther himself would like to quote, I forget what passage is it. Somebody maybe could pull this out of their ear or out of their head. It's from the New Testament. Our life is hid with Christ in God. And Kierkegaard, for instance, talks about the knight of faith, K-N-I-G-H-T. He's a warrior, he's a cavalier of faith, but everybody thinks he's just some kind of shallow dilettante who goes to the opera and has a picnic in the deer park while the world is in flames around him. But Kierkegaard says that guy has faith. And I heard Susan Briel last week. Some of you know Susan from a couple of village. She was the leader, one of the leaders, with Marty Haugen, no less, of a worship conference in Canada. And she was dynamite. So was Marty Haugen, incidentally. But she said, talking about self-care, how Christians, including Christian pastors, ought to take care of themselves as well as their flock. And she said, to go to sleep is an act of faith. I take a nap every day, and I take a nap at Holden Village, and I figure that's an act of faith. You know, I'll let all the world's problems to God. Okay, the life hid with God in Christ, Niebuhr calls that dualism. Christ and culture and paradox. You've got to make this, walk this tightrope between the demands of faith and the demands of the world. Number five, Christ the transformer of culture, what Niebuhr calls conversionism. And conversionism, well, I should tell you some other people besides Luther who take position number four. Paul, the Apostle Paul, the heretic Marcion, whom I don't know much about, Luther, whom I think I do know a little bit about, Kierkegaard, whom I think I know a little bit about, you're not surprised to hear Kierkegaard put in there, Trelch, I don't know much about him, Ernst Trelch, T-R-O-E-L-T-S-C-H, he was a theologian of the last century. I think Gerhard Abeling and people like that today still are would put themselves in that category. Okay, moving on to the fifth category here, Christ the transformer of culture. This is the possibility that Christ's men, Christ's women, can get into the culture and transform it. You don't have to sit there and be a victim. One of the problems with position number four is it tends to be a little paranoid, and it leads sometimes to quietism. The kingdom on the left hand is going to take care of itself. All I worry about is the kingdom on the right hand. Well, that can be quietism, and you have a lot of German Lutherans who were very quietistic during the Nazi era and have that answer to at the judgment day. Further, it can be kind of paranoid. Luther is always hiding out in the Wartburg from his enemies, I mean psychologically, and I tend to think in those ways too. That you're surrounded by a world that may be hostile, and let's pick up the survivors if we can. Let's be good at eleemosynary stuff. Lutherans have always been good at hospitals and institutions for the handicapped in one way or another. That's to our refugees, my Lord. The Lutheran World Federation after World War II did a magnificent work, still doing that work. We're great at that. Lutherans are great at that kind of stuff. But it's kind of reactive instead of proactive. You get what I'm saying? Number five comes along and says, let's be proactive. Let's not let those things happen, those terrible disasters. Let's have Christians who are good family members, good fathers, good mothers, good children. Let's have governors and princes and kings and emperors and judges and mayors and city council people who are Christians and who can make a difference. You saw the movie with David Brower on Saturday night. Some of you were here then. You know, he's an ecologist and advocate for the creation. You have to listen to him. Boy, he's dynamite. Same with the culture. Let's have Christian artists. Let's have Christian scientists. You know what I mean. You know, Christian doctors, Christian teachers, and so on. And let's see if they make a difference to convert the culture, to make the culture different. Again, some people who would emphasize that aspect of things would be the gospel writer John, says Niebuhr. St. Augustine, says Niebuhr, but you can find Augustine in number four, too, let me tell you. John Calvin, as you might guess, and F.D. Maurice, whom I don't know at all, but he was a theologian whom Niebuhr likes from the last century into this century, kind of Victorian, Edwardian. And those people all want to see the culture transformed, and the culture can be transformed. It certainly can be. And I think H. Richard Niebuhr himself would put himself in that category. Okay, let me conclude with this wonderful quotation from Luther, and then we'll throw it open to conversation for the last 10 minutes or more. I got this from Carol Hinderly long ago here at Holden Village. The Christian witness is this: we are the Lord's with and without the apostrophe. With and without the possessive. We are the Lord's with the possessive, with the apostrophe. That means we belong to God. We belong to the Lord. And that's neat. But also, without the apostrophe, without the possessive, we are lords, kings, queens, rulers of our world. And we can do what we want to with our world. And that's a privilege. And I believe that. You have a lordly, a kingly, a royal responsibility. And a royal authority. That's wonderful. Okay, let's talk.
We are lords under one Lord, right?
Say it again.
We are lords under one Lord.
Yeah, sure. That's a good way of putting it. Created co-creators. I like that, too. You've heard that maybe from some other theologians. We are created co-creators.
You started talking earlier about the church changing. I mean, would you think that most Christian churches now are like in the fifth, the transformer of culture, conversionism type religion or denominations?
Yeah, I would argue that this, in a kind of corrupt form, position number five becomes American civil religion. Mm. In other words, number five is pretty easy to understand. Number four, this Lutheran position, I think, is difficult for people to understand and get a handle on. So you won't find many Lutherans in this world. You'll find a lot of number five. You'll find a lot of Calvinists. And you'll find a lot of number three, synthesists. And as a matter of fact, they got a lot in common. You scratch a Calvinist, I've said this to my Calvinist friends, you scratch a Calvinist and you got a high Middle Ages Catholic. They always want to put the cross over City Hall. I mean, that's them at their worst. Calvinists always want to kind of baptize everything. I mean, at their worst. Let me tell you, I know what Lutherans are at their worst, too, and that is they're quietists. And they're paranoid. But that's okay. I mean, as I say, I'm willing to be number four. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, though.
No, that's pretty good.
Some more?
When I think of Bonhoeffer, I don't think he fits exactly.
Yeah, I've described Bonhoeffer. In fact, in this graduate course I was taking with this professor at Syracuse, I read Bonhoeffer's newly published Ethics. They published his Ethics in English some years before, and then there was a new revision that put him in a better chronological order. And comparing those two versions of Bonhoeffer's Ethics, I wrote a paper that argued that Bonhoeffer began at number four and turned in his ticket and became number five. He thought that the two kingdoms, the Lutheran understanding, was too quietistic, fatalistic, and didn't stand up against Nazis good enough. So he became a Calvinist. I told this to a Luther scholar, and he was a little outraged.
But I think that maybe this gentleman's point here is that I remember there was a television program on last year about Bonhoeffer, and I don't know if this really...
We're going to see a television show about Bonhoeffer on Wednesday night here.
He went into this church, and with all the altar and cross and everything had been damaged by bombs, so it was a big wreck. And he turned around from the altar and he said, "This is the end of religion.
Ooh.
From now on, the church will be a church without religion."
Yes.
Which I think that maybe he might consider himself number six.
Yeah, and I've gone around the country making speeches. Bonhoeffer was wrong. We're never going to do without religion, creed, code, cult, and constitution. Norma Jean Baker had to live as somebody, whether it was Marilyn Monroe or not. You see my metaphor here? There are certain things that just go along with being a human being, and you cannot do without them. Again, I'm not sure whether that completely addresses your question, but religionless Christianity, yes, that, and exactly what Bonhoeffer meant by that, we don't know, because he died too young. How old was he when he died? 33 or something? My Lord.
Well, just thinking of another category here. My experiences of Lutheran churches up in Canada, many of the different congregations I've belonged to, there's a category, I think, that would be Christianity avoiding culture. in the sense that you could go to a church service and you might, let's say you have the transcript of a pastor's sermon from 1995, and the same sermon could have been preached in 1925. Mm-hmm. There are no cultural references. It kind of goes back to Michael's sermon last night, where it's sort of half-saved. It goes as far as the personal and the spiritual and so on. There are references to the creed and the scriptures and so on, but which friggin' century or decade or what social issues are there? You know, it's Christianity done in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, the people go there and they get a little shot of whatever it is, comfort. But there's
feel good.
Yeah. There's really no challenge or anything, and that's very sad.
Would you propose another category then, or would you?
Well, for my experience, none of those particularly describes my experience of Sunday worship or common Christianity, where I think so much we avoid culture, we avoid the difficult issues. And the homosexuality or whatever, or the complicated issues of economics and globalization, and we just keep things simple. I mean, the Altar Guild does it this way, and the choir perfects a certain song, but it's all done in isolation to the real issues of the day.
And there's very little real engagement, you're saying, with any of this stuff.
Exactly.
But that's just a variation of number one, isn't it?
I think it is.
Almost, yeah.
There's no railing against culture. There's no condemning, you know, the flesh.
From rather than against. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It could be number two, Christ of culture, and it's just so, we're just so...
A little louder?
Yeah.
It could be number two, Christ of culture, and we're just so comfortable middle class that it's, you know, why need to talk about it?
Yeah.
It's all just become meshed together.
Yeah, it's probably closest to number two.
Consumerism, yeah.
Yeah, but there's no flag waving or anything. It's not as though there's an American flag or a Canadian flag, or there's no real, you know, baptizing of the culture. Somehow there's still a removal from it for safety's sake or something. But I like the phrase avoiding culture.
But even if they think they're avoiding culture, they can't, okay? Because you always
they go back to it, yeah.
So that's how it's sort of culture is the backdrop,
yeah.
But it's not consciously. Mm-hmm. Looking at its relationship to it.
I think that a sermon that was given in 1995 that may have been written in 1925 largely reflects the fact that the message of salvation is very simple. Christ is saying yesterday, today, and forever. And sometimes I wonder if the church's attempt to deal with social issues is not one of simply trying to rationalize sin. Mm. I'll throw that out, and I realize that that's going to offend some people, but I've been wondering about that for some time.
Yeah, yeah. I remember taking a course in great preachers, and my teacher was Edmund Steinle. Some of you know that name. And he had us read sermons from various ages and various cultures. And apparently John Henry Cardinal Newman, Victorian Edwardian convert, I think, from Church of England to Catholicism, and then became a bishop and a cardinal. But his sermons were very much of the type that you're describing, almost timeless. You could preach that sermon in almost any century. But it was a good sermon, by golly. But you're right, that is, Klaus, you're right too. You know, it didn't have a lot to say about contemporary problems in family or government or economics or any of those things.
I wanted to comment on number four too, Christ and culture and paradox, the dualism, the right hand and the left hand, and thinking how I think that has been helpful, or can be helpful, in admitting that there are gray areas. For instance, if I'm not mistaken, the church's social statement on sexuality and the paragraphs on abortion, saying that abortion, I'm not quoting it, but basically the idea is abortion is always a sign of a brokenness. It's probably sinful, but sometimes it's the lesser of two evils. And so
that's very Lutheran.
And so on the one hand, let's say a teenager, a Lutheran girl, gets pregnant at age 15. She knows she doesn't want to have an abortion, or that it is going to hurt someone, the fetus, whatever. But the left hand, the hospitals, the government, and so on, permits abortion, and therefore she goes there, and the church doesn't bless it, but acknowledges this can happen.
In a broken world, it's like the cruel sea, you know, the guy with the U-boat and the.
And then the gal or the family, the mom, I mean, everybody involved can go back to church, and back to the pastor. And receive the word of reconciliation and the acknowledgement that
this is
love. You know, it's not black and white. So I think number four could be very helpful in some of the complicated decisions of life.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I can hardly think of an ethical issue that is clearly good versus bad. It's always a little of both.
Mm-hmm. So you're a Lutheran.
Yeah, and I'm pretty comfortable as a Lutheran, but a Lutheran is never comfortable. I mean, that's part of our genius. It's pretty close to quitting time, but... one more word?
I was just going to say that the assumption Niebuhr makes is that Christ is. And I think in a lot of our world today, that's not an assumption at all. That there's no relevance at all between Christ and any of the things you're
talking about. Any of this, yeah.
So, I mean, there might be some people who would talk about religion, but not Christ.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Civil religion. Which makes its own problems. Okay, tomorrow, friends, we'll get into church architecture. Wednesday, the body and movement. Thursday, music. And Friday, words and signs. And tomorrow, I'm going to denounce Gothic architecture. That's how offensive. That's how offensive I'm going to be.
You want to paint a Gothic steeple picture?
Okay, let's quit.